In the world of counting mitzvot, there's a machloket of whether or not you count derabanan or deraita. The Rambam doesn't count derabanan. He doesn't count mitzvot that are the rabbis, only those that come directly from the Torah. The Ramban disagrees. Okay. Yes, yes. Now there is a mitzvot that the Rambam does speak about.
Did you say counts?
The Rambam, for other reasons, only wants Rambam, Maimonides, only wants things from the Torah. Now, he does enable us to include a little bit of mitzvot that are only rabbinic in nature, because in the Torah itself, it's written, you shall follow the words of the rabbis. So he's able to include all of the Derabbanan as a deraita from that verse. The Ramban, however, Nachmanides, has the specific mitzvot of Hanukkah and Purim and the like. And so there are differences in how we count the 613. They both come to 613, but for other reasons, the Rambam, Maimonides, says if you count every rabbinic as a mitzvah, there's no end. There's no 613. There's thousands and thousands, and so therefore he includes it all into one category. The mitzvah we're actually going to talk about is not one of the four mitzvot. I'm sorry about that. I apologize. The mitzvah we're going to talk about today is not actually one of the four mitzvot of Purim that we're accustomed to talking about, the Megillah and the Matanot Avyonim and things along those lines, the Suda. We're going to talk about something that takes place right before Purim. And in fact, this is actually have a Torah source. But the rabbis changed the nature of the Torah source, and that's what I really want to focus on. So you'll see the top of the source sheet says Machzit HaShekel. What is the Machzit HaShekel? So the Machzit HaShekel is sometime, well, we can read it in fact, the first source from the Shulchan Aruch, and it's talking about giving money in the mitzvah of giving money to the poor, Ma'ot Purim La'ani'im. It says as follows: Chayav kol adam leten lefachot shtei matanot leshnei aniim. Okay, that's the mitzvah poem. You should give at least two gifts to two poor individuals. Yeshomrim shehem leten kodim poorim machsit min hamatbea. And the Rama adds, there are those who say that there is also a mitzvah to give before Purim. Machsit min hamatbea, half of whatever the currency is, wherever you may be living. Be'oto makom, be'oto zman. Why? Zecher lemachsit hashekel shehayu notnim be'adar. That in the time of the temple, in the time of the desert, in fact, in the Midbar, what would happen is the Jews would give half a shekel to cover all the costs for the coming year for the needs of the temple. So before the first of Nisan, which means any time during the month of Adar, you had to bring a half a shekel. What was the value for this half a shekel? It had actually two purposes. The first purpose I already mentioned, it was to basically a tax to cover all the public karbanot, the public sacrifices, whatever the upkeep of the building. It's a significant amount of money. If you think about 600,000 Jews, each giving half, right? That's 300,000. It's a significant amount of money. And they would do that every year. What's the second reason why everyone gave a half a shekel?
Isn't it a count for the soldiers?
Not just soldiers. It was the census. Not just the army. It was a census. How do you know all these people in the tribes? So you don't have to count each head. You count each half shekel, and then you know the exact amount. That's why the halacha today is there's a machloket, there's a disagreement of how do you fulfill this mitzvah. One opinion says, like the Shulchan Aruch writes, the Rama writes, it should be a half a shekel, meaning in Israel, it should be a half a shekel. In America, it should be a half a dollar. The other opinion is you give the value of what was a half a shekel in biblical times. So you figure out the weight of that. You figure out what does that then cost in silver. I think it comes out to be around 32 shekels. And people give, therefore, 32 shekels, and you can give it in a check. But what's the difference? So those who say you should give the actual half shekel, right, which, by the way, is not as good for fundraising purposes, right? It's But it's connected more to the mitzvah of actually being able to count how many people gave as opposed to how much you collect. So the mitzvah is to give it any time. Yeah.
Is it better to give to upkeep something versus
right. Yeah. So it's interesting because this mitzvah is included within this. And the custom in our shul is we have two separate pots. One goes specifically to aniim and the poor, and the second, the machzir shekel, because it was, in a sense, for the purposes of covering the temple, so it covers the costs of the shul. But there's certainly not a problem to give it to the poor or anything along those lines. So this had to be brought before the first of Nisan, and that was how it was done biblically. What do you know about this machzir shekel, this mitzvah, though? When do we give it? We give it before Purim. That's the 15th of Adar. The rabbis changed the nature. Now, why would we change the nature? You, I'm sure, are all familiar with Jews, right? Jews don't like doing things earlier than they have to. If you remember back in America, you know, April 15th was tax day, you go to the post office, you could have a lot of minions, right? Yeah, exact stamped April 15th, 1159. So why all of a sudden do the rabbis say we have to do something beforehand? So there is a joke, and I don't know if it's a funny joke or not, but it's one of the few times the joke is actually incredibly appropriate and actually sheds insight into the what we're learning. So there's these two guys, they go out into the woods, they're in a cabin, and all of a sudden they hear a pounding at the door. And one of them goes and looks out the window, through the door, whatever it is, and there's a huge grizzly bear. And the huge grizzly bear is about to pound through the door. The other guy is sitting on the bed, he starts putting on his running sneakers. You know, they were relaxing, they had taken off their shoes, everything like that. He's putting on his running sneakers. And the guy who's at the door says, "What are you doing? Why are you putting on your sneakers?" He says, "I'm gonna run away from the bear." And he says, "Well, you know that you don't, there's no way you're gonna outrun this bear." And the guy who's putting on his sneakers says, "I don't have to outrun the bear, I just have to outrun you." Get it? Right? The guy bears. Oh, that's a bad one. Okay. But at least it has a relevance for the actual learning. The essence of this mitzvah is we move it to April, or not April, we move it to Adar, the middle of Adar, before Purim, to teach us the point that it doesn't matter when it comes. We don't care if it comes really before the first of Nisan or the first, before Purim. That's not the important part. What's important is that it has to come before something else, someone else's shkalim. That brings us to the next source, the Gemara and Megillah. You look below. The Gemara and Megillah says as follows. The print is not so great. Let's see where I want to start from. Okay, so the top of the first line, in the middle of the line, this is Haman asking of the king. He says, "Al haMelech tov yichatev la'avdam v'aseret alfim kikar kesef." He asks the king, he asks Achashverosh, "I will either," there's a difference of opinions, "I will either give you 10,000 talents of silver or I will collect 10,000 talents of silver, and let me use this money in order to make sure to kill all the Jews. Right, if it will be good in the eyes of the king, yichatev, it should be written la'avdam, to destroy them. And the way the vehicle by which we'll make sure that it happens is this 10,000 talents of silver. If you look to the left, we won't necessarily read it, but the Tosafot, source number C, he points out that 10,000 talents, asarat alfei kikar kesef, he had once heard what the amount of kikar kesef is, and it comes out to be, if you see the third line, olim chetzik shekel, it is equal to a half a shekel for every Jew, for every year, while they're in the desert. So that's how there's a relationship between the 10,000 kikar talents of silver that Haman wants to bring to kill the Jews, and 10,000 talents of silver that were collected by the Jews while in the Midbar. What's the relationship? Amar Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish says, "Galui v'yadui lifnei misha amar hayarulam." This is just a flowery language of speaking about God. It is known clearly before the one who knows everything before the world was created. Shatid, that in the future, Haman lishkol shkalim al Yisrael, that Haman was going to come and he's going to weigh out shekels, he was going to weigh out money in order to kill the Jews. Lefichak, therefore, he deem shkalehem lishiklo, Therefore, God gave us a commandment of weighing out a half a shekel, right? I said it was for the purposes of the temple. The Gemara says, according to Reish Lakish, no. The real reason why we brought the half shekel, yes, it was used for the temple, yes, it was used for the census, but the real reason is because Hashem, of course, knew that there was going to be a Haman. He was going to bring money, and we have to bring our money to counterbalance the power of Haman's money. And therefore, we have to come before him, and so since his money comes and has an impact when? On Purim, our machzir shekel has to come before his money. And therefore, that's why the mitzvah of bringing half a shekel always comes right before Purim. You can do it any day up until Purim begins. After Purim begins, it's no longer of a value. Biblically it is, but not according to the rabbis. So the question is, why is it important that we bring our shekels before Haman's? What is the significance of Haman's shekels? What is the significance of our shekels? So to do that, I want to sort of digress for a moment. What? Yeah, he provides right, the cure before the disease. But what is the disease, and what's the cure? So I want to just look at sort of a global view of Purim for a moment. Because one of the things you'll begin to see when you look at Purim is that it's a very odd holiday. Obviously, it's an odd holiday. But it's not just odd by the practices we do. All the practices we do, we call it a Chag of Simcha, right? But it's not 100% Simcha. There's always something waiting in the shadows, that there seems to be some type of ominous nature to Purim that limits the amount of Simcha. And what I'd like to suggest is you could see it in the halachic nature of the practices of Purim itself. So I'll give you just a few examples. If you look at source number 2, this is the Rambam on Hilchot Avel, on the laws of mourning. When a person passes away, we obviously have certain laws that we're bound by in terms of avelut, in terms of mourning. Many of those laws are pushed off if we have holidays, right? If you don't sit Shiva during Pesach, you don't sit Shiva during Purim. I'm sorry, during Sukkot, by the way, as an aside. I just read this terrible article. Did you see this article in Florida for the tragedy of the gun shooting at the schools, that the newspaper reporter, the sheriff, says how terrible it is. I keep going and I have to, all these people are sitting Shiva. The newspaper reporter had never heard that apparently, and he wrote, and it was picked up by, it was the AP, so it was picked up in the New York Times, all these places, that all these people in Florida are sitting and shivering. terrible.
They didn't.
No, because they were quoting the police officer, and they misquoted him. He says, they're sitting Shiva, and they said, they're sitting and shivering, and they put it in quotation marks. So, anyway, so we sit Shiva. I mean, we don't sit Shiva during a Chagim. Why? Because we basically say that, as sad as it is personally, when a person loses someone close to them, that if you are connected to the Jewish people, if you're connected to the eternity of the Jewish people, which is manifested in our Chagim, of God saving us at Pesach, of Sukkot, of all these, then it diminishes a certain degree of the sadness of being in mourning, and therefore it pushes it off or cancels it, depending upon when exactly it falls out. However, Purim, which you would think is this holiday of great joy, should absolutely cancel it completely, right? Because the same way, just like Pesach cancels it, it's like Sukkot, this Purim has tremendous amount of joy. So if you look at the Rambam, however, the underlined parts, it says, fourth line down, Shem HaMoed, Moed is Pesach, or Sukkot. Moed Asur Behesped Uta'anit. You are forbidden to give eulogies, and you're forbidden to fast on these holidays. And then it goes on to say, and we don't do a whole series of other customs. These were more ancient customs, but we don't do any customs that have to do with mourning during the Chol HaMoed. And obviously, the Ein Tzarich Lomar Shar Krovim for all the other instances as well of relatives in this regard. Now the Rambam is going to talk about Purim. V'chein, and similarly, ein masbidim et hamet b'chanukah u'b'purim. Chanukah and Purim, even though these are very joyous holidays, you don't give eulogies on these 2 days. V'lo b'rosh chodeshim, and also not on Rosh Chodesh. Aval noagim behem kol divrei avelut. Everything else, however, all the other forms of avelut, sitting shiva, you would nevertheless do on Purim, and Chanukah, and Rosh Chodesh. So there's clearly a distinction between Purim, on one hand, and the other holidays. Now, what would you say is probably the distinction, based upon what else he mentions here? It's not just Purim, it's also Chanukah, right? It's also, so perhaps it might be an issue of Derabbanan versus Deraita, meaning of Rosh Chodesh, but Rosh Chodesh is Deraita, so it's an interesting question. So anyway, I was going to reject the idea that it's a question of Deraita. Rosh Chodesh would be one way you reject the idea, because that's also from the Torah. But there's another way you can reject that that's the distinction. And if you look to the right-hand side, it talks about the Sheva Brachot of a wedding. That if a person's in the middle of Sheva Brachot, the week of getting married, and God forbid, a parent passes away or anything like that, you don't sit Shiva. Now, during the 7 days, you wait until afterwards, the 7 days of the feasting. You don't mix them. So, according to the Rambam. So, the Sheva Brachot, the celebrations of the wedding, that's Derabbanan. That's not Deraita. So, there's a case of Derabbanan having the power to push off the morning. So, why not say the same thing for Purim? Okay, fine. Hanukkah, Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh is great, a holiday, but it's not necessarily the day of great joy. Hanukkah is wonderful as well, but it's not defined as such simcha, right? Yemei Mishteh, days of feasting, which is the same way we describe the Sheva Brachot, days of feasting. Why doesn't Purim have the same power as the Sheva Brachot, the days of feasting following a wedding? Why don't they have the exact same power? What? So they're not usually, but that would be the distinction of Torah, meaning it's a chag that pushes off because it's a deraita. But as you said, Rosh Chodesh could be. Rosh Chodesh is certainly called the moed. But it seems to be something about Purim that it's not enough. It doesn't have enough power to push it off. What are some of the other oddities of our practices? If you look on the next page, what is one of the mitzvot that we engage in on Purim? One of them, of course, is matanot levyonim and mishloach manot. What's odd about those two mitzvot? Matanot levyonim. Forget mishloach manot. Forget matanot levyonim for a second. Mishloach manot. It's unique to Purim, right? You give a gift to another individual. When a holiday has a unique mitzvah, what do you usually do? Make a bracha. Before you, right? I'm going to shake the lulav. I make a bracha. Why? I blow the shofar. I make a bracha. Why? Eat matzah. I make a bracha. Why? Here's the unique part of Purim. I'm going to give a gift. Why don't I make a bracha beforehand? Right before I give it to him. In fact, that's the question on source number 3 in the Tamayim and Nagim. Tam she'ein levarchim al mitzvot mishloach manot b'Purim. Why don't we do it? You should make a bracha. It's like any other mitzvah. Why not do that? Another question. It's a big, long Gemara that you see below from Megillah. What don't we say on Purim that you would expect us to say? Okay, Shechianu could be one thing, which we say, right, so. Yeah, okay, right. Well, that's one of the biblical, we say it when it's a biblical mitzvah, but you're getting there, right? Hallel, right? Hallel is said whenever you have these great... Hallel we do say on Rosh Chodesh. Hallel we do say on Chanukah. And certainly with regards to all the Deraita holidays, we also say Hallel. So why on Purim? Purim is the one day you would think, absolutely, you do say Hallel. Purim is the one day we don't say Hallel. Right? You're getting a sense here that Purim, which we think is a day of great joy and simcha, and everyone's always dancing and celebrating, there's something deficient in the nature of the joy that we celebrate. Hallel, which expresses joy perhaps better than anything else, is not said at all Purim. It's very, very loud here. There's certain suggestions given why we don't do that. In the Gemara, for example, let's see, I'll read in the English. If you go to the fifth line, that they ask the same question, why don't we say Hallel for Purim? At the end of that line, if for being delivered from slavery to freedom, we chant the hymn of praise, meaning Hallel, should we not all the more so for being delivered from death to life? What's the argument they're making? What's slavery to freedom?
Pesach.
If you're alive, but you're oppressed, and you now go to be free, that warrants making saying Hallel. It's a Kal v'chomer. It's an all the more so. You're about to die, and now you're going to live. For sure, the emotions are just as strong, if not stronger, than what took place on Pesach. Why shouldn't we then say Hallel as well? So they give some technical reasons. We do not say Hallel because it is not said for a miracle which occurred outside the land of Israel. Purim took place outside of the land of Israel. But what are you going to respond? So too did Pesach. Pesach took place in Egypt. So the Gemara then says, well, yes, but that's before we entered Israel. Once we entered Eretz Israel in the time of Yoshua, all other miracles that take place outside of the land of Israel, we don't say Hallel for. All other miracles that take place inside, we will say Hallel. So it has to do with an Eretz Israel type of argument, which we will perhaps refer to. The Gemara is not so convinced by that as well, because individuals might say Hallel if they have a personal miracle that takes place outside of the land of Israel. So they give other answers. Well, when we read Megillah, that's just like Hallel, so therefore we don't have to say Hallel as well. But the Gemara is uncomfortable with all these answers. There's suggestions offered, but none of them are 100% convincing. So why don't we say Hallel? Okay? Another question. Look at the source number 5. What's not necessarily a mitzvah of Purim, but everyone will tell you it's a mitzvah of Purim? Hasidim are particularly good at this mitzvah. Right? Drinking. Right? It's, by the way, it's not out of nowhere. It's brought down in the halacha. And if you see 5a, Tam shechayvu chachamim lishtaker bepurim. The rabbis say you must get drunk on Purim. But they ask a question. V'halo b'kama mekomot da Torah maskir shehu mikshol nahul b'shichrot kamo noch v'lot. Wait a second. It's a mitzvah to get drunk on Purim, and we'll see the source of it in a moment in source number B, the Gemara. It's a mitzvah to get drunk on Purim, but haven't we seen throughout history when you get drunk, it potentially creates potential dangers? For example, Noah. We know the story of Noah, that after he comes out of the flood, he plants the vineyards, he gets drunk, and something happens between him and his son. We don't know if it's just revealing his nakedness or if it's something worse. You know, some people suggest that a rape takes place, but clearly something negative takes place as a result of the drunkenness. And Lot, the exact same thing takes place with Lot, right? Lot and his daughters, they get drunk, right? And inappropriate relations follow. So we have at least these two clear cases, but here the rabbis go out of our way to say, no, you should get drunk on Purim. Right? Why to do so? So the Gemara itself explains why we get drunk, which actually just makes the question even stronger. So during their Suda, Amar Rabba says, Mechayev inche lipsume beporia. A person is obligated to get drunk on Purim. By the way, the Aramaic for getting drunk, lipsume, sounds like what? Bisamim. Spices. So actually, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein used to say that if you're getting drunk, it becomes like spices, meaning all these beautiful Torah comes out of your mouth, and you're sweeter with everyone, and you love the whole world, right? There are two types of drunks, right? You see drunks who just love everyone, and then there are drunks who get very angry. He says, if you're the first kind, lapsume, then it's a mitzvah to get drunk. If you're the second kind, don't get drunk. It's not worth it. It's not worthwhile to do so. Nevertheless, Rava says, it's a mitzvah to get drunk on Purim. And he goes further. Why? Until, how do you know you're drunk? Ad lo yada ben Aror Haman lebarach Mordechai. Until you don't know the difference between blessed is Mordechai and cursed is Haman. In other words, that you're so drunk that you might start to say, Baruch Haman, blessed is Haman, and cursed is Mordechai. Why in the world would you ever want to get drunk First of all, why do we get drunk in general? Okay, it's to be filled with joy. Tehillim says that wine gladdens the heart. Okay, so it's a part of becoming joyous. But why would you want to get so joyous that you then aren't sure whether or not you should bless Haman or Mordechai? Why? And you see that. You ever see, like, you go to yeshivas, they actually have songs like that, testing whether or not they're drunk enough. They sing, Arar Mordechai Baruch Haman, and when they can't keep it straight, that's how they know they've reached this category. Why would we ever want to bless Haman? What possible reason could be for that? And just to add to the question of getting drunk in general, you see the Gemara continues with this famous story that I'm sure many of you have seen before. The famous story of the meal. Rava v'Reb Zera, right? So this is a different Rava, right? The above Rava is with an Aleph. This is Rava with a Hey. Rava v'Reb Zera, Avru Sudat Porn Bahadeh Hadade. They had a Sudat together. By the way, Reb Zera is a very interesting figure, and perhaps just keep in the back of your mind, he's one of the most Zionist rabbis that you could think of. He lived in Bavel, and he wanted to come to Eretz Yisrael, and his teacher, Rav Yehuda, says, you can't come because there's the three oaths. You're familiar with the three oaths? The Satmar Hasidim very often quote the three oaths. Three oaths say that the Am Yisrael promises, God made us promise, that we will not return to Eretz Yisrael, right, until the time of Mashiach. And so anti-Zionists who say that we shouldn't be here is because, well, how you violated the three oaths, one of the oaths at least. And that was Rav Yehuda's opinion, who was Rabbi Zera's Rebbe. Rabbi Zera disagreed with this. He felt, well, that's only if the non-Jews of the world treat us fairly, but if we're being oppressed outside, they didn't keep their oath, we don't have to keep theirs. So there's a whole other series of reasons as well. You don't have to wait until Mashiach, you can wait until there's a process of Jews returning, which could lead to Mashiach. In any event, Rabbi Zera, however, did not want to have this confrontation with his Rebbe. His Rebbe said, no, you can't go. So he hid from his Rebbe for a long, long time, so he wouldn't have to tell him that he's still planning on going. He eventually does come to Eretz Yisrael. He gets so excited when he gets to the Jordan River. He just like rushes through the Jordan River, and all these people in Israel, the Vatikim, see him come through, and they laugh at him, and they say, you know, you're such a silly person. You got all your clothes wet and everything like that. And he says, wow, I'm going to worry about, you know, my honor. Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't make it into this land. I get to make it. I'm going to be thrilled. He runs right in. You know, many of us have similar experiences. If you've made Aliyah, you know, and you get off the plane and you kiss the ground and, you know, people mock you, what are you doing? He also says that he, which is interesting, he says that in order to be a true Israeli, it's important to forget, not just focus now on learning in Eretz Israel, but forget all of your previous learning. So he actually said, they said he fasted 100 days in order to forget all the Babylonian Talmud that he had learned previously, so he could only focus on the Yerushalmi Talmud, rather than the Babylonian. He felt, and Rav Gorin, who was a chief rabbi more recently, actually picked up on Rebbe Zera's point and says it might be problematic to learn the Babylonian Talmud because a lot of foreign theology, Zoroastrianism, it's like sort of seeped in to the Babylonian Talmud. So sometimes you're reading the Babylonian Talmud and they'll, you know, give certain medical suggestions or advice and you wonder where does that come from, and Rav Gorin, at least, quoting Rabbi Zera, felt it might be because it's from a foreign religion, therefore it's always better to learn the Yerushalmi, the Palestinian Talmud, than the Babylonian. Anyway, that's just a little history on Rabbi Zera.
Yerushalmi is more red?
Yerushalmi's not. The Babylonian
I
think the Babylonian is more well known and used for a couple of reasons. One is we didn't always have full access to the Yerushalmi. Second, the Babylonian Talmud is much richer, meaning it's far more volumes, a lot more give and take. It includes a lot more of what we traditionally call the learning. And there's ways of sort of minimizing out. If you read all of the commentaries in Rashi, Tosfot, you could try to sometimes take out some of the things that Rabbi Zera was concerned about. Rabbi Zera, by the way, ended up moving to Tiberias, and he was the first, like, Kiruv rabbi. The story tells him how he would walk the streets, and there were these like ruffians, and that no one wanted anything to do with these ruffians. And he would always sort of go and hug them on the streets and bring them closer to Judaism. And when he died, they all came to his funeral, and they were all weeping and weeping, and they returned to Judaism. They became Baalei Teshuva because of Rebbe Zera.
Okay. Oh,
say it one more time.
Amalekite become a Ger.
Yeah.
Can become Jewish?
Yeah, why are you asking?
Because maybe there's some, you said why can't you bless Haman, but maybe he had some famous, very good descendants.
Oh, interesting. Kind of like Korach, the story of Korach, who's his children. We're going to come, I'm going to, that it's an interesting idea of whether or not that can be in there. We don't have the, okay, we'll have to look at that idea further. Okay, so anyway, so Rebbe Zera, they sit down to do a meal together. They get drunk, ipsum. Kam Rabba gets up, shachte le Rebbe Zera, and he kills Rebbe Zera. He takes out a knife in the middle of their meal, they got drunk, and he kills him. Lemachar, bai rachmane, the achye. So the next day, or a little bit later, Rabba feels bad for what he did. He prays to God, and Rebbe Zera comes back to life. Okay? I don't know what that means, but that's what the Gemara tells us. This might be another reason why Rebbe Zera decided to make Aliyah. If this is what's going on in Babylonia, maybe he felt like I should celebrate Purim other places. And anyway, Lashana, the next year, Amar Le, Rabba says to Rebbe Zera, Nite Mar, let's have a Purim meal again together. And at this point in time, Amar Lei, Rebbe Zera says to him, Lo b'chol sha'ata v'sha'ata, we cannot count on every single moment, every single hour, mitchayish nisa, that there's going to be a miracle every single time. In other words, no thanks, I'm not taking a chance that you're going to do this again. Which just, of course, strengthens the question. At the very place where the Gemara tells us it's a mitzvah to get drunk, it raises two challenges. To get drunk so much that you may want to bless Haman. And secondly, we see the dangers in getting drunk that it could lead to murder. Why would we ever want to get to this stage? Other oddities with regards to Purim that seem sort of inconsistent with what we traditionally understand normative Jewish practice. I didn't bring them down, but there are other practices that we do as well. What's odd about Purim?
That's what?
Odd about Purim. Other things we do on Purim that are a little bit strange. I'll just mention two that I wrote down here. What?
Give
to the poor, but there's always a mitzvah of tzedakah. I mean, you're right, it's a special mitzvah, and that's a big important part of this. How about getting dressed up? Right? We hide who we are. Right? We try to become who we are. We try to reveal ourselves. Here, we try to cover who we are. And not only are we hiding who we are, you can actually violate halacha in order to do so, right? Men can dress as women. Women can dress as men, right? So it's not just like a fun Halloween type of practice. It actually has halachic stature that allows you to push off halacha. There's something valuable in covering up and pretending to be someone different. What are we supposed? Now there's a joy there. It's a little bit of an odd joy, right? It's not you who's having the simcha. It's you dressed up as someone else who's having the simcha. There's something odd there as well. The last thing I would mention, although I think there are other examples as well, is that God is not mentioned at all in the Megillah, right? God's always mentioned, and of course Purim is also connected to Parshat Tetzaveh, which we just read, and in Parshat Tetzaveh, Moshe is not mentioned. Right, there seems to be a hiddenness, and that's of course what we talk about with Purim. We talk about it, Hester Panim, that God is hidden somehow from this entire holiday. So it's a holiday of tremendous joy, but the joy has something missing within it. God is not involved. The joy is we cover ourselves either with clothing or perhaps with drunkenness. Right, it's not the joy, sort of a natural joy. Right, Sukkot. What's the joy we have at Sukkot? Water, right? The Simcha Beit HaShoeva. That's natural, right? You're overjoyed because you're experiencing an event of the water, pouring water onto the Mizbeach, and everyone's come together. That's the joy. Not the joy that comes from drunkenness, which is a little bit chetzi joy. You don't even remember that you're so joyous, right? Because it's a little bit different than who you are. It's not joyous enough to recite Hallel. It's not joyous enough to push off Avelut. There's a whole series of different examples as well. Question is, so what is it about Purim that is making it a joyous day, but not a fully joyous day? And I had one more question in that regard, is Purim is unlike other holidays in that, according to the rabbis, it's one of the only holidays that we will celebrate for all time. In other words, when Mashiach comes, we don't celebrate Pesach anymore. Okay, it's done. We now, right, the Mishnah actually speaks about, what, up until now, until Mashiach comes, the greatest redemption we've experienced is the redemption that took place in Egypt. But after Mashiach comes, you'll remember Pesach, you know, once in a while, but not every day that you'll be thinking about Mashiach. Purim, it's not like that. You will continue to celebrate Purim even after Mashiach has come. So what's special about that holiday that suggests that you still would celebrate this holiday? Tisha B'Av is the other holiday, right? Tisha B'Av, what does it mean celebrate? Because Tisha B'Av will be flipped. All of a sudden, Tisha B'Av, which is a day of great mourning, when you rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, it will become a day of great joy. So what's going on with Purim that, in a sense, we're not celebrating it right now, but we will celebrate it right in the future such that it will last for all time? Okay. Those are some of the questions. What I'd like to suggest is there's a way of answering all these questions that helps explain what Purim is really all about. And one of the ways you can do is to try to find parallels between Purim and other holidays or other texts from the Torah. This is done a lot, by the way. If you look at a rabbinic text, if you could find similarities between a rabbinic text and a Torah text, very often the rabbis either purposely or subconsciously use similar language to alert us that what the message they're trying to give in Purim is similar to a message that the Torah was trying to give as well. Anyone want to suggest an idea? What does Purim sound like when you read through the text? Does it evoke any images of Torah text? So the Data Mikra, in the introduction of to the Megillat Esther, gives us some parallels. It may be, I don't know if I gave, there's an English page on the source sheet. I don't know if I included in with yours. No? Okay.
Tribe of Benjamin, so we're trying to correct history.
Tribe of Benjamin, right. So that's one of the ideas, certainly, right? It's the story of we're correcting, right? You know, the Tribe of Benjamin is already a correction in itself, right? It's a correction of what took place with Yosef. And how did we correct it? We corrected it with love, right? The brothers stepped forward to protect Binyamin, whereas before the brothers sold Yosef into slavery. And Mordechai is a descendant of Binyamin. He's, in a sense, a descendant of that concept of love. So we can even see it more in if you go specifically to the story of Yosef. So first of all, how is Yosef described in the Torah? How is Yosef described in the Torah?
Good looking.
How is Esther described? Right? Good looking. There's a lot of these parallels we'll see in a moment. But in Data Mikra, he actually brings actual psukim that send him back to look at the story of Yosef. So for example, in Breishit, when it tells about the king establishing representatives, kidim, right, clerks throughout the land. Vayifkod kidim ala aretz, and the king Yosef also sent these clerks throughout the land. Vayitzu et kol ochel, right, he had to collect all the food and bring it together. And this thing was good, vayitev hadavar be'enei paro. This was good in the eyes of paro. Achashverosh, now in the story of Esther. Vayifkod hamelech kidim. He also appointed clerks, v'chol medinot, in all the land. Vayikpatzu Koha Na'ara, he collected all the women, right? In the case of Yosef, they collected all the food. He collected all the women in order for his beauty pageant. Ve'yitev ha'davar be'enei ha'melech. Same language. I can give you this afterwards if you want to take this so you have the actual language. There's a number of other examples. Yosef says, whether or not he's going to be successful or not. Vanika asher sikalti. I will, if I fail, I fail. What does Esther say? Kasher ibadati ibadati. If I fail, I fail. Yosef, or not Yosef, the brothers say, ki ech a'ale el avi. The brothers are, how could I possibly go up to my father if I don't have Binyamin, the boy with me? Penore bara asher yimtza et avi. I can't possibly see the evil that this will cause my father. Ki echeche uchal v'riti. This now is Esther. She says, how could I possibly stand v'riti b'ra'a and see the same word, ra'a asher yimtza et ami, the evil that will befall my people, whereas before, the evil that will befall my father. There's a whole series of psukim that are very, very parallel, suggesting that maybe we should look at the story of Yosef. But more than that, there's a number of just clear examples. One of them we already spoke about. We spoke about the idea of beauty between Yosef and Esther. Correct. Yosef and Mordechai, they both are elevated, right? They wear their clothing, and they're paraded through the streets in both instances as the second in command. They also, in both cases, save everyone, right? Mordechai, by the way, some suggest that Mordechai doesn't just save the Jews. When Mordechai reveals that there's an assassination attempt against the king, that was part of a revolt. And if the revolt came through, there would have been total chaos. So Mordechai not only saved the king, but he saved the kingdom from war. Yosef saves the entire kingdom. When does that miracle take place with Mordechai saving the king?
During the time when it seems the most perilous.
Right, right, okay. And how about in the king's life himself? I shouldn't say when does it take place. When does the king remember it? In the middle of the night when he can't sleep. And what? How is Yosef redeemed? Through dreams. When Paro, it says, Vayekam, he wakes up because he had a dream that awakes him. In both cases, the king can't sleep, and that's the window that opens up for either Mordechai or for Yosef. In both cases, there's a hanging, right? In the case of Yosef, it's the steward, right, who is put to death by hanging, and in our case, it's Haman. I just wrote down a few other instances of that might be connected. The identity of the person is hidden, right? Esther, we don't know that she's really the hero. We don't know that she's Jewish. You're not 100% sure. So too with Yosef. Initially, he's hidden. He's in the prison. No one knows who he is. You can sense that there seems to be a strong connection between these stories. So when you think that there's a connection, you can look back at the texts themselves and see what might we be able to learn. So to do that, I want to now look at the source on the last page that you have, which is just from Shmot, right, from Sefer Shmot. Vayamat Yosef. This is after Yosef has passed away. This is going to introduce what I would suggest is perhaps the first time the Jewish people experience anti-Semitism, and perhaps suggests what is the source of anti-Semitism. The first time something appears, in a sense, creates the primal energies that are taking place. So perhaps the anti-Semitism here, perhaps, you know, emanates throughout all time, or at least echoes throughout all time. The Torah says this follows: Ve'yamat Yosef, and Yosef dies. V'chol echav, v'chol hador ha'u, and the entire, all the brothers, and all of that generation. Uvenei Yisrael paru v'yishuretzu v'yirbu, they were fruitful, they multiplied, they spread out. V'atzmu me'od me'od, they became very, very strong. V'timilei ha'aretz otam, and they filled up the entire land. Right, Jews have spread throughout the entire land. Vayakam Melech Hadash, and this is the pivotal line, and a new king arose. Vayakam Melech Hadash al Mitzrayim asher lo yadat Yosef, who didn't know Yosef. Vayomer el Amo, and then he turns to his nation and says, "Let's get him." Right. So something has happened. The Jews are living fairly peacefully. In fact, elevated status because Yosef and the brothers have an elevated status in the eyes of the Egyptians and Paro. Something happens. It brings forth a new king, Vayakam Melech Hadash. A new king arises, and that new king wants to now begin to oppress the Jews. So what happened? Now, I'm going to give sort of a philosophical answer, based upon the rabbinic sources. You should know that there's a parallel answer, which is a historical answer. Many people suggest, for example, that when Yosef came down with all the brothers, they came down, and part of the reason they were able to connect with the Egyptians is because years previously, there were a group of non-Egyptians, Hyksos, okay? Hyksos, who would have come down probably from Turkey, are Semitic people, like the Hebrews, and they conquered Egypt. But they were a minority within Egypt, but they were the ruling powers in Egypt. And they had all the power, the kingship, they had everything. But the masses of the people were not of the same ethnic makeup. But Yakam Melech Hadash suggests a new king arose, meaning there was a revolution. The native Egyptians overthrew the Hyksos. And at that point in time, when the native Egyptians overthrew the Hyksos, who are they also going to not like so much? Whoever had any type of positive relationship with them, which would have been the Jews, who had also been a Semitic people at that point in time. So there is a historical suggestion of how to read this verse. The rabbis read it slightly differently. If the key words is in Pasuk Zion. Uvenei Yisrael paru v'yishritzu v'yirbu v'yatmu me'od me'od v'timaleh ha'aretz otam. They multiplied and they grew and they filled up the entire land. Now that can be read positively, but you hear in the language also a degree of negativeness, right? V'yishritzu. What does the yishritzu sound like?
Like bugs.
Bugs, sherets. Yes, they multiplied, but they multiplied like bugs. They spread out everywhere. That's a very negative connotation, in fact, in describing the Jews growing. Now, what's a negative connotation from a Jewish point of view? It's not the idea that there are many of them, but they behaved like bugs. They behaved in an inappropriate way. That's the Midrash. If you look right below, V'timaleh ha'aretz otam, and the earth was filled with them, right? What does it mean, the earth was filled with them? Not just that there were lots of Jews. She'nitmalu batei tatariot, all of the theaters were filled with the Jews. Batei karkasiot, and all the circus houses, okay? By the way, what's a theater? What's a circus house in the time of Egypt? Don't think of the Jerusalem theater. Think of the Roman amphitheater or the Roman Colosseum, right? The theaters and the circuses of Egyptian society was not high-level culture. It was the opposite. It was, you know, where the masses came and all the inappropriate things you could possibly imagine of people being killed in front for sport and sexual immodesty and immorality across the board. That's what was taking place in these places, at least according to the rabbis. And the rabbis understand, v'timaleh ha'aretz, the Jews filled the land, not just that they became populous. They filled all the places of the land. They basically became the lowest common denominator of all the people in Egyptian society. And that's why the language for Yishritzu, they behaved like bugs. They lost their Kedusha, right? And we know this. The Gemara often speaks about that. The Am Yisrael, right, had to be rescued when they were rescued because they had descended 49 levels of Tumah, of impurity. And if they had gone the 50th, they wouldn't have been saved. They had totally assimilated into the worst of Egyptian society. That's the next statement of the Midrash. Vayakam Melech Hadash. What does it mean, a Melech Hadash? Who is the Melech for the Jewish people? God. Vayikam Melech Hadash is not a new Egyptian god arose. For the Jews, a Melech Hadash, there was a new king. They no longer believe that God is the source of all of their salvation. They ignored God. Melech Hadash, they loved Egyptian society. They loved running away from traditional Jewish values, and they loved connecting, assimilating with the general society that they had, which included a running away from not just fellow Jews who were more traditional, right? Running away from Moshe. Moshe doesn't appear in the Parsha. They also ran away from God, which they run away from holiness in general. And so therefore, how do we know this? What does the Midrash say about this line? They revolted. Bagdu ki banim zarim. They became strange, just like there's a new king. They became new. They became strangers. And they gave birth to strangers. How do you give birth to a stranger? They didn't give circumcision to their sons. This is to teach us. Kishemet Yosef, when Yosef died, hafru brit milah. After Yosef died, they kept it alive so long as Yosef was alive. Once Yosef passed away and the brothers, they no longer felt an obligation to their traditional grandfather, their traditional father, and they got rid of brit milah. They wanted to assimilate, be just like everyone else. And therefore, and this is the key insight of the Midrash here, the Kavan, and once they did that, this is in source B, the sixth line down, the Kavan she'asuchin, once they did that, hafach HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ahava, God, hafach, right? Nafochu, it's the same language we use in Purim. Hafach HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ahava, God flipped over the love, shehayu haMitzrayim ohavim otam, that God switched, changed the love that the Egyptians used to have for the Jews into hatred. In other words, the rabbis say, what's the source of anti-Semitism? The source of anti-Semitism is internal. It's a radical statement. It says, when the Jews decide to run away from God, when God is not given any voice, they run away from their tradition, when they run away from one another, they're not. They want to be just like everyone else. Means I want to be an Egyptian. I don't want to identify as a people. I don't want to be people of that anymore. When we run away from all these different things, so God then switches the love that people felt for them into hatred. Why does God do that? Because in that hatred, you now have to actually come together as a people. You no longer are allowed to assimilate, right? When you lost the opportunity to be assimilation, you're closer to God, closer to other Jews, and ultimately, hopefully, that becomes the push to turn closer to God as well. It's a very painful idea, what the rabbis are saying at this point in time. But if you think about it for a moment, it's very parallel to perhaps what's taking place in the story of Purim. What's the history of Purim? Right, we're in exile. How does the story open? We're at this huge party. Days, weeks, months of party with all the drinking you can possibly imagine. No one says that it was kosher wine that was being served. And all the food that you can possibly imagine. And all the activities that would take place in a royal palace. And if you want to get a sense of what the activities would be, think about what the king was doing. The king was bringing in beauty pageants left, right, and center. This was not a holy place. There's no mention that the Jews stood outside and protested. Right? The Jews participated like everyone else in this sort of, these are the circuses and these are the theaters of Ahasuerus' court. And so therefore the Jews have begun to assimilate. We can see it in a few different ways. One is they're at this party. There's no mention that anyone is overly observant. Esther, who doesn't appear to us to be observant at all. I mean, she's participating in this whole, you know, beauty pageant. She has a recollection of being Jewish. She has her religious uncle, but she's embarrassed by him. She's like, you stay outside. Why are you wearing the sackcloth? Come on, you know, stop being so Jewish. There, by the way, I should say there's a parallel midrashim that say, I'm wrong about this, that Esther actually was very holy and very religious, not assimilated at all. That's why we eat the poppy seeds, right? You know the story? That Esther, her entire time when she was in the king's palace, she kept kosher. But she couldn't find kosher food. So the only thing she could eat were poppy seeds. And that's why when you eat the poppy seed Haman, is the Ozne Haman, is to remember that. But the pshat seems to be that she's an assimilated Jew. When did this whole story take place? This takes place after Jews were already allowed to return to Israel, right? The previous kings had said, you can return, rebuild your temple. Only 40,000 Jews actually returned. The vast majority of Jews said, we like life in
America.
We like life here in, you know, wherever they are. We like this life. We like being modern Jews. We like assimilation. And we don't need to go. So they ran away from their people, which is, they didn't return to Israel when they're given the opportunity. They didn't connect to God. That's why God's not in the reason why God is not in the Megillah is not just because God is hiding. The Jews had a Melech Hadash. They also didn't necessarily need to do that. So now look at all the things that we've seen previously. All the oddities of Purim, okay? All the oddities of Purim are joyous, but but incomplete. And that's because what I would suggest is Purim itself is we're rescued. We're saved, but how are we saved? We're saved by this very negative form of anti-Semitism. In other words, Haman comes up, and he says, I'm going to kill you all. By the way, how's he going to kill us? With the silver. I'm going to kill you all. What do the Jews then do? They realize that they're in this thing together. Esther turns to all of the Jews and says, I need you. I need you fast on my behalf. I need you to daven. I need you everything. And what are all these Jews? Let's say the religious Jews too. The religious Jews, what do they? They realize, oh, I need Esther. I need the secular Jew just as much as I need the religious Jew. We are one people. We can't separate ourselves. We can't think that I can live okay in the palace and no one will be harmed. And I can't live outside the palace as thinking that, you know, what goes on inside is not relevant to us. We're all fully connected. And so what the entire story of Purim is all about is bringing us together. And we all come together. We have this incredible moment of unity. And we celebrate it, right? We all prayed for one another. We all are rescued. Esther saves us. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. But it all comes about because Haman brought us together. We didn't come together on our own. We had to be forced to come together by Haman in the same way that we were forced to come together in the time of Paro. So we have joy, and the joy emanates from unity and love amongst Jews. That's why we have Mishloach Manot, all these things. But the cause of it all is a very sad fact. We came together because we had no other choice, because people hate us. You know, after tragedies, people come together. That's not the ideal way of coming together. Now look at all the practices we have. So we don't say Hallel. The Gemara goes on. Why don't we say Hallel? Because we're still, at this point in time, we're still servants of Achashverosh, meaning that they still didn't come to Israel. In other words, it's not a complete joy because we still didn't correct that which needed to be corrected. We don't make a bracha matanot levyonim. Why? Well, the truth is we don't actually make a bracha on any mitzvot ben adam l'chaveiro. Why? Well, we're worried about making a bracha levatala, a wasted bracha. What's the essence of the bracha of Mishloach Manot? Just because I'm short on time, I'm not reading it, but you can look inside. He says the essence is ish l're'ehu. You're giving a gift to someone who you love. Well, we can't test whether or not you really love the person. I mean, that's only inside a person's heart. So if you don't really love a person and you give them Mishloach Manot, and if you made a bracha, so then maybe it's a bracha, a wasted bracha, because you didn't have the proper kavana. And by the way, maybe that's why we don't make any brachot ben adam l'chaveiro, right? Tzedakah, I don't make a bracha before I give it to you, because the whole essence of a ben adam l'chaveiro is to say, I truly love you, not because of the outside, but because internally I have these feelings for you. I love you, and therefore all the actions between human beings, we don't make a bracha because you don't have the kavana. But there's one exception. Can you think of one exception with the mitzvah ben adam l'chaveiro, which we do make a bracha? Right, you get married. That brings us back to that first source. Remember when we were talking about Avelut? We said Deraita pushes off Avelut. Derabanan doesn't, except in one case. What's the one case of a Derabanan that does push off Avelut? Getting married. The brachot, because there you do know that you have the proper kavana. It explains the getting drunk. We're joyous, but it's the joy that comes from not the ideal source. Joy of getting drunk is different than joy of just pure joy of unity. So all these things, it's a joy that we have, and that's the Machsida shekel. Our shekels have to beat Haman's shekels. What do Haman's shekels represent? They bring us Haman's shekels. He collects the money to have his killed. Represents Jewish unity, but Jewish unity out of fear. What does our shekels represent when we bring the half shekel? Our shekel represents Jewish unity out of love, out of a positive, affirmative position. And that's why it's a half a shekel. Because when you bring the half a shekel, what's the most obvious thing about bringing the half a shekel? You need another person to make a complete shekel. It can't be just by yourself. So the whole symbolism of bringing the half a shekel before Purim is to say that I want to celebrate Purim the proper way. I want to connect with another person out of love, not out of fear. And that's why I would suggest Purim is the one holiday that we're going to celebrate for all time. Because at this point in time, we're celebrating Purim incorrectly. Getting joy without Hallel, without getting drunk, without God, with all these things, that's the joy of Haman. That's the joy of Paro. So we celebrate it, but it's incomplete. When we finally make the switch and we fulfill the kavana of the half shekel properly and we do it out of love, so then we go to the next stage, and that's the Purim we'll be celebrating for all time, which is we don't need it from fear, but we do it out of love. Have a good Purim. Reish Lakish with Baal Tshuva. Baal Tshuva. Yeah. Happy Purim.
Thank you.
Pleasure.